Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to the program that helps you improve your American English skills. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world. We speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. We also urge you to print the stories you are about to hear and save the audio as a podcast. That way, you can go back again and again to practice. Today, we will talk about a way to raise money over the Internet for special projects. Then, we will visit a prison in the state of California where the men behind bars are being taught unusual but much-needed skills. As It is the name of the program, and we are coming to you from the Voice of America. Crowdfunding is a way to raise money from a large number of people over the Internet to support a project. Crowdfunding has become common in many Western countries. Kickstarter and Indiegogo are two crowdfunding websites. Such sites have helped launch Western-operated projects. Yet crowdfunding websites are almost unknown in Africa. Recently, the World Bank launched a program to help business owners in Kenya make use of crowdfunding. The bank's Kenya Climate Innovation Center provides crowdfunding mentorship programs for small companies. A World Bank study found crowdfunding could have a major effect in the developing world. But to raise money through websites, business owners need specific skills. Edward Mungai works at the Kenya Climate Innovation Center in Nairobi. He says business owners need to be well connected to both individuals and organizations. He says they also need to know how to show their ability to use the money they collect. Finally, he says they should show how their business would help society. Three businesses in the program have launched campaigns. One of them is Wanda Organic, an organic fertilizer business. Marion Moon started Wanda Organic 3 years ago. Like many small African entrepreneurs, Ms. Moon found it hard to finance her business. So Ms. Moon says she decided to try something unusual, online crowdfunding. She says banks would not finance her business in the early days. She had to depend on friends and family to keep her business going. In some ways, Ms. Moon says, crowdfunding is similar to the more traditional ways Kenyans raise money from their communities.
I think the word crowdfunding is new to people, but the idea or the principle of everybody putting in a little bit to help a project, I don't think that's new at all. So I think one of also the things maybe we could have done better is how we linked what people are used to this word crowdfunding.
Edward Mungai says getting local support for crowdfunding has not been easy. He says most of the money is still coming from Westerners and not from Kenya.
Unfortunately, the people who are being reached, they cannot be able to contribute because there is no infrastructure to contribute.
He adds that most Kenyans do not have credit cards. Marion Moon notes that those who do have credit cards are worried about online security. Her Wanda Organic is halfway through its campaign. The company has only raised around 6% of its $45,000 goal. She has 1 month left to raise enough money to build storage centers for her fertilizer. The campaign has been slow, she says, but she has not lost hope.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. Prisoners in California are learning how to write programs for computers, an activity known as computer coding.
It is a skill that many employers are seeking in new workers. Christopher Cruz tells us all about it.
Computer coding is now being taught at San Quentin State Prison, just north of San Francisco. The class began last year. It is believed to be one of the first such classes in an American prison.
Starting with a simple web page, it's just an HTML file.
18 prisoners are listening closely to their teacher. He is speaking to them on a video conference system. Gary Valentino Hollis is learning to build a web page with the computer programs JavaScript, HTML, and CSS.
Bingo. Here we go. And then we push Control Save. And it should come back refreshed.
Mr. Hollis was found guilty of attempted murder in the 1990s. He has been in prison for 20 years. Soon after he completes the coding class in April, he will be released from San Quentin.
Oh, my God. This is truly an honor and a blessing to be in this type of setting, especially here in prison. This is a million-dollar dream. Because it gives a lot of men hope, such as myself. Getting out in about 108 days, but who's counting? Getting out, I know I have a skill now that I can market to provide the means for my family and to be a productive citizen than I was 20-some years ago. You know, everyone deserves a new chance. So this is my new chance, my new way of life.
The class was the idea of a nonprofit group called The Last Mile. Chris Redlitz and Beverly Parenti set up the group. Both have worked in the high-tech industry. On his first visit to San Quentin, Chris Redlitz wanted to find a way to teach prisoners skills that would help them get a job after they were released. At first, Beverly Parenti was not supportive.
And my first reaction was, are you kidding me? And that's not actually what I said, but I don't think I'll say that on the radio. And then I actually went in and met some of the men and talked to them and learned their stories and saw their passion and enthusiasm and intelligence. And I quickly agreed that I would help Chris launch The Last Mile inside San Quentin, which was not an easy task, but we were determined. And we didn't take no for an answer. We took no as a kind of a way to work harder. And so we basically had a startup of our own inside San Quentin, and that's the beginning of The Last Mile.
The first problem was no internet connection. Prisons in the United States do not let prisoners use the internet. So Mr. Redlitz and a computer coding school called Hack Reactor developed a program that does not require connectivity. Hack Reactor provides volunteers to train the prisoners. They provide training on a video system from outside the prison. There was another problem. When the program began, half of the students had never used a computer. Gary Valentino Hollis said learning computer programming was like learning a foreign language.
I mean, I don't even know how to turn on a telephone. I don't even have a clue what an app is or how to turn it on. There's times I feel very, very frustrated. But the give up part is not in the blood. There's not one guy in here that has that on their mind of giving up. We all work as a team. The thing is, see on the wall up here, they got, it says believe in the process, and that's what it's about. Believing in the process, and that's keep working, and it eventually clicks.
The class lasts for 6 months. Prisoners study for 10 hours a day, 4 days a week. If students miss class or behave poorly, they are immediately removed from the class. Chris Redlitz says he believes the class will help the prisoners when they are released.
You know, the opportunities are huge, especially in this industry. You know, if you can write great code, people really don't care much about your background. Just write great code and you've got a job.
When the prisoners complete the course and are released from prison, there is a good chance they will not return. That is because they will be able to find a job that pays well. Chris Redlitz and Beverly Parenti hope to expand the Last Mile training program to other prisons in the western United States. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for joining us today. Be sure to come back tomorrow for another class in Learning English from the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. More than 6 million people around the world suffer from Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease makes patients shake and their muscles difficult to move. The disease is incurable and only gets worse over time. Current treatments for Parkinson's are medicine and surgery. But lately, many doctors and patients have become interested in a treatment that is simple, does not cost much, and seems to be very effective. That treatment is exercise. What you hear are 20 senior citizens exercising. The instructor watching them closely is a 75-year-old man named Gary Sobel. When he was younger, Mr. Sobel was an athlete. In his early 60s, he was still running in long races. But in 2008, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. The condition became severe. He could not get out of bed without help. He could not walk easily. He could not drive a car. Doctors told Mr. Sobel the best way to avoid accidents and injury was to avoid exercise. So Mr. Sobel stopped exercising. He also avoided medications because he was scared of the side effects, the bad things they might cause. Then one day, his hands were shaking so much he could not sign his name to pay a bill. After this happened, Mr. Sobel started to take low doses of Parkinson's medicine to reduce the shaking. Once the shaking lessened, he started squeezing water from wet towels to strengthen his hands. That simple exercise worked. Mr. Sobel decided to build on his success. He moved on to exercises to strengthen his legs. Then he decided he wanted to help others. So he trained to be an instructor. Mr. Sobel has been teaching exercise classes for 3 years. In that time, he has helped thousands of people with Parkinson's. The medical community noticed the success stories of Mr. Sobel and other Parkinson's patients who exercised. Dr. Heather Ean is a doctor at the University of Colorado. Ms. Ean says new research about Parkinson's is making doctors change their advice to patients. Now, doctors are telling people with Parkinson's to exercise longer, more often, and at higher intensity. She says exercise may help people remain more active for longer. Back in class, Mr. Sobel says the classes have also helped him fight this degenerative disease, a disease that gets worse over time.
This is a degenerative disease that can get nasty. But I'm winning the battle right now. And I don't know how long I can continue to win the battle, but I'll do what I can.
As part of doing what he can, Mr. Sobel has trained over 100 instructors throughout the United States. I'm Anna Mateo. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Soon after the Civil War ended in 1865, thousands of Americans began to move west to settle the land. The great movement of settlers continued for almost 40 years. The Great Empty West, in time, became fully settled. The discovery of gold had already started a great movement to California. This week in our series, Robert Bostick and Leo Scully tell about the Gold Rush and the important part cowboys played in settling the West.
Men had rushed to the gold fields with hopes of becoming rich. A few found gold. The others found only hard work and high prices. When their money was gone, they gave up the search for gold. But they stayed in California to become farmers or businessmen or laborers. Some never gave up the search for riches. They moved back toward the east, searching for gold and silver in the wild country between California and the Mississippi River.
Each new gold rush brought more people from the east. Mining camps quickly grew into towns with stores, hotels, even newspapers. Most of these towns, however, lived only as long as gold was easy to find. Then they began to die. In some of the gold centers, big mining companies bought up all the land from those who first claimed it. These companies brought in mining machines that could dig out the gold from deep underground and separate it from the rock that held it. These companies needed equipment and other supplies. Transportation companies were formed. They carried supplies to the mining camps in huge wagon trains pulled by slow-moving oxen. Roads were built, and in some places, railroads.
The great wealth taken from the gold and silver mines was usually invested in other businesses: shipping, railroads, factories, stores, land companies. More jobs were created in the West, and living conditions got better. More and more people decided to leave the crowded East for a new life in the West. But the big Eastern cities continued to grow. New factories and industrial centers were built. People moved from the farms to find work in the cities.
The growth of these industrial centers created a big demand for food, especially meat. Chicago quickly became the heart of the meat industry. Railroads brought animals to Chicago, where packing companies killed them and prepared the meat for eastern markets. Special railroad cars kept the meat cold so it would remain fresh until sold. As the meat industry grew, the demand for fresh meat increased. More and more cattle were needed.
There were millions of cattle in Texas, but no way to get them to the eastern markets. The closest point on the railroad was Sedalia, Missouri, more than 1,000 kilometers away. Some cattlemen believed it might be possible to walk cattle to the railroad, letting them feed on the open grassland along the way. Early in 1866, a group of Texas cattlemen decided to try this. They put together a huge herd of more than 260,000 cattle and set out for Sedalia.
There were many problems on that first cattle drive. The country was rough, grass and water, sometimes hard to find. Bandits and Indians followed the herd, trying to steal cattle. Farmers had put up fences in some areas, blocking the way. Most of the great herd was lost along the way, but the cattlemen believed they had proved that cattle could be walked long distances to the railroad. They believed a better way to the railroad could be found, with plenty of grass and water.
The cattlemen got the Kansas Pacific Railroad to extend its line west to Abilene, Kansas. There was a good trail from Texas to Abilene. Cattlemen began moving their herds up this trail, across the Oklahoma Territory, and into Kansas. At Abilene, the cattle were put on trains and carried to Chicago. In the next 4 years, more than 1.5 million cattle were moved north over the Chisholm Trail to Kansas. Other trails were found as the railroad moved farther west.
Trail drives usually began with the spring roundup. Cattlemen would send out cowboys to search the open grasslands for their animals. As the cattle were brought in, the young animals were branded, marked, to show who owned them. Then they were released with their mothers to spend another year in the open country. The other cattle were put together for the long drive to Kansas. Usually, they were moved in groups of 2,500 to 5,000 animals. 12 to 20 cowboys took them up the trail.
The cowboys worked hard on a trail drive. They had to keep the herd together day and night and protect it from bad men and Indians. They had to keep the cattle from moving too fast or running away. If they moved too fast, they would lose weight, and their owner would not get as much money for them. The cowboys would walk the cattle only 20 to 30 kilometers a day. The cattle could feed all night and part of the morning before starting each day. If the grass was good and the herd moved slowly, the cattle would get heavier and bring more money.
In the early 1880s, the price of cattle rose to $50 each, and many cattlemen became rich. Business was so good that a $5,000 investment in the cattle industry could make $45,000 in 4 years. More and more people began raising cattle, and early cattlemen greatly increased the size of their herds. Within a few years, there was not enough grass for all the cattle, especially along the trails. There was so much meat that the price began to fall.
There were two severe winters that killed hundreds of thousands of cattle. An extremely dry summer killed the grass, and thousands more died of hunger. The cattle industry itself almost died. Cattlemen also had problems with farmers and sheepmen. Farmers coming west would claim grassland used by the cattle growers. They would put up fences and plow up the land to plant crops. Other settlers brought huge herds of sheep to compete with cattle for the grass, and the sheep always won. Cattle would not eat grass where sheep had eaten. Violence broke out. Cattle growers fought the farmers and sheepmen for control of the land. The cattlemen finally had to settle land of their own, putting up fences and cutting the size of their herds. They no longer could let their cattle run free on public lands.
By the late 1800s, the years of the cowboys were ending. But the story of the cowboy and his difficult life would not be forgotten. Even today, the cowboy lives in movies, on television, and in books. When one thinks of the Wild West of America, he does not think of the miners who opened the way to the West, nor does he think of the men who struggled to build the first railroads across the wild land. And one does not think of the farmers who pushed slowly westward to fence, plow, and plant the land.
The words Wild West bring to mind just one character, the cowboy. His difficult fight to protect his cattle on the long trail was an exciting story. It has been told by many writers. Perhaps the best known was a young Easterner, Owen Wister. He worked as a cattleman for several years, then wrote about the heroic life of the cowboy in a book called The Virginian. Another Easterner who came west to learn about the cowboy was the artist Frederick Remington. Remington was a cowboy for only 2 years, but he spent the rest of his life painting pictures of the West and writing about it. His exciting works made the West and the cowboy come to life for millions who never saw a real cowboy.
The cowboy has also lived in music. He had his own kind of songs that told of his problems, his hopes, and his feelings. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Robert Bostick and Leo Scully. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, along with historical images, are at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.